Yeah, so it's a pleasure to have Rob Meyer here from the University of Arizona. He'll be talking about modular equations and special functions transformations.
Well, thanks very much to the seminar organizers for inviting me. If I'm standing in an appropriate place or if I walk in front of the screen, just let me know. I'm going to stand here and click through these various transparencies. I'm very happy to be here to talk about special functions and special function identities. For the last several years, I focused increasingly on that, and although I got started by focusing on the purely algorithmic aspects of special functions and algorithms used to derive special functions identities, I have become more and more geometric, in fact, algebraic geometric, the goal being ultimately to answer a very hard to make precise and hard to answer question. How many special function identities come from geometry? And when I say come from geometry, I mean especially from algebraic geometry. Here is a really high-level overview of my talk. The first paragraph here, or first stanza, doesn't say very much except define Picard-Fuchs equation. Most people here know what a Picard-Fuchs equation associated with a one-dimensional family of algebraic varieties is. I'm going to be talking mostly about elliptic families, pencils of elliptic curves, or equivalently elliptic surfaces. To remind you briefly what it's all about, we have a family of algebraic varieties. Let's think of elliptic curves. There's a base curve. The fibers are these algebraic varieties, such as elliptic curves. And the base curve is to be thought of as a compact Riemann surface, an algebraic curve in this one-dimensional case. And with the exception of a finite number of points on that Riemann surface, the inverse image of this projection map, the fiber is supposed to be a well-defined algebraic variety in this class. If one focuses on a single fiber, a single smooth fiber, and chooses a holomorphic N form, assuming that we have n-dimensional algebraic varieties here, on that fiber, and moreover, we choose N cycles, however many we need in order to give a basis to the nth homology, then we can extend out from there. We can extend both of these concepts, cohomology and homology, to the entire parameterized family of algebraic varieties. We can extend the holomorphic n-form to what amounts to a meromorphic family of n-forms on the entire family, and that's not necessarily a unique extension. One can multiply by any meromorphic function on the base, for example, to get another extension. And one can extend the cycles too. In general, one gets a multivalued extension. If you want to think more concretely about what I'm going to focus on, think about the periods that one gets by integrating the form omega against the cycles. It's known that they satisfy a Fuchsian ordinary differential equation on the base. Fuchsian ordinary differential equation simply means ordinary differential equation with regular singular points only. That's what we call the Picard-Fuchs equation. In other words, they are special functions. Now, this is a very abstract definition of Picard-Fuchs equation. If you haven't seen it before, or if you're not as expert as one or two people in the audience, then don't worry about the abstraction. What I'm going to be talking about, leading up gradually to recovery of Picard-Fuchs equations in a special function context, is the lower blue portion here. Think of a family of elliptic curves. The base could be some familiar rational modular curve, such as x naught of n, which I will define in a moment. Covering in modular relations among these families of elliptic curves, for example, the fact that the modular curve x naught of mn is a certain fold cover of x naught of n, looks as if the x naught got left out. They induce relations among Picard-Fuchs equations, which are differential, to be thought of as differential equations, on these base curves. And in other words, they are necessarily going to yield special function identities. That's a really high-level overview of what this talk is about. I'm going to start out in a much more concrete way. First of all, let me mention a few papers of mine, one on the archive, one on the transactions, and one which is more computational than anything else. But Andreas likes the Hoyne equation, so I'll bring in a few slides on the Hoyne equation. From the point of view of adding geometrical or algebraic geometric insight to the sort of special function manipulations that I go through, some papers by Helena Verrill at Louisiana State and also Charles Doran up at Seattle have proved very useful indeed. The latter bringing in lattice polarized K3 surfaces, which I'm going to touch on only at the very end. Okay, back to square one. What are special functions? Well, special functions have been a subject of investigation and interest in the mathematics and applied mathematics and theoretical physics communities for a very long time. You're familiar with standard compendia like the Bateman Manuscript Project and Abramowitz and Steichen and so forth. The simplest sort of special function, if you want to dignify it with that name, is simply a function, a meromorphic function in the function field of an algebraic curve. The simplest case is the projective line, where a meromorphic function on said curve means exactly that. On an elliptic curve, meromorphic functions would include things like Weierstrass's P function, Jacobi's SN function, and so forth. Those are a little too simple. Those are meromorphic functions in the function field of a compact Riemann surface. The next step upward in complexity is functions that satisfy, let's say, linear homogeneous ordinary differential equations on some particular algebraic curve over the complex field with meromorphic coefficients, meromorphic meaning in the function field of that curve. Now, we could operate either in a scalar context where we focus on scalar ODEs or on systems of first-order ODEs, and I will focus simply on scalar ODEs. So there's our a linear differential operator, which annihilates some function. And a solution of this is going to be said to be a special function and of interest to us as mathematicians. The case when this algebraic curve X is itself the base of a family of algebraic varieties, that is the one that gives rise to a Picard-Fuchs equation, as I explained on that first tangled original slide. Now, let's start out with the simplest possible Fuchsian ordinary differential equations, regular singular points only. Let's think about the projective line curve that carries these particular differential equations and special function solutions. The simplest case is when we have a second-order simplest non-trivial case is when we have a second-order ODE on the projective line with three regular singular points. That gives us, by definition, the Gauss hypergeometric equation or something very closely related to that, or the Hoyne equation if we have four regular singular points. Möbius transformations, automorphisms of the projective line, are three transitive. We can map any three points to any other three points, so we might just as well choose the three points to be 0, 1, and infinity on the complex plane of the Riemann sphere. Also, we might as well canonicalize the characteristic exponents of our ODE, our second order ODE, or to put it another way, canonicalize the monodromy around each of these singular points. And there are various ways of doing that. One standard way is to choose a projective form in which the second order ODE doesn't have a first order term in it at all. That is not the form that I will use because that's not the standard one in the classical theory of special functions. A point should be made, very painful from many points of view, which is that in general, a Fuchsian ordinary differential equation, even on the projective line, is not uniquely determined in general by its characteristic exponents. There may be so-called accessory parameters in there, which have a global rather than a local monodromy theoretic interpretation. If you will, they affect the global monodromy, but not the local monodromy around each of the singular points. The Hoyne equation has an accessory parameter, which in many applied mathematics contexts shows up as a spectral parameter. The Gauss hypergeometric equation does not, and I'll write those down for you so that you can see them in a moment. The standard solutions of the Gauss hypergeometric equation and the Hoyne equation are the ones which are analytic at x equals 0, one of our three or four singular points. And normalized to unity there's an analytic solution around x equals 0 simply because one of the characteristic exponents there is set equal to 0 by definition. People who are heavily into series manipulations and combinatorics would probably prefer to think of the associated special functions 2F1 and HL simply being the analytic germs which are converged to by particular Taylor series which have the property that their coefficients satisfy two-term and three-term recurrences. That's how one would look at it from a classical analytic or even combinatorics-oriented point of view. Not quite mine, but at least I'll write down the recurrences for you. This is the Gauss hypergeometric equation. It has three parameters. I call them A, B, and C. That parameterization goes back a long way. It goes back, in fact, to the days before Gauss. There's a second-order differential operator. This is not in projective normal form. There is a first-order term. And the characteristic exponents of the three singular points are, by definition, 0, 1 minus c, 0, c minus a minus b, and a, b. Why those three particular numbers? Well, that gets back to the original definition of the solution of this differential equation, the Gauss hypergeometric function, 2F1, as depending on three parameters, a, b, and c, in a particular way. We might define the equation somewhat differently if we were defining it from scratch these days. This particular analytic solution around x equals 0, the x equals 0 singular point, it has a convergent Taylor expansion, converges on the unit disk, and there you see the two-term recurrence that I mentioned. It's a very simple two-term recurrence, and it makes clear why the three parameters A, B, and C are chosen the way they are. It's so that the recurrence will look nice. The recurrence came before the differential equation. Gauss wrote down the differential equation based on earlier work on hypergeometric series, which we now interpret as the Taylor series that I just referred to. The Hoyne equation and its series solution, again, analytic germ defined at the origin, is given here, and it has more parameters, as you can see just by looking at it. Call them alpha, beta, and gamma, delta, and epsilon. You see three singular points in there explicitly, x equals 0, x equals 1, x equals infinity is a singular point, and so is some fourth singular point, x equals a, which is left unspecified. It's a free parameter because you cannot standardize its location by applying a Möbius transformation. Fuchs's relation on the exponents of any Fuchsian ODE relates alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and epsilon this way. So one of them is redundant. The accessory parameter is this quantity right on the end, little q. It's not exponent-related. It's related to global monodromy instead of local monodromy. The zero exponent solution, meaning analytic solution at x equals 0, is usually denoted HL, and it has a convergent expansion. The expansion's coefficients generate what's called a Hoyne series, and it's to be thought of as the next step upwards in complexity beyond a Gauss hypergeometric series. It converges in a neighborhood of the origin, and there you see the three-term recurrence I mentioned, the one which is satisfied by the Taylor series coefficients or Maclaurin series coefficients. The various parameters of the Hoyne equation show up in the recurrence. It's not difficult to see that any generic Taylor series or Maclaurin series in which the Taylor or Maclaurin coefficients satisfy a three-term recurrence with coefficients that are quadratic in n, the index, is going to be a Hoyne series. I should perhaps qualify that by saying that the final quadratic coefficient that you see here, the coefficient of c sub n plus 1, it had better have n plus 1 as a factor. If it does, then you have a Hoyne series, as you can readily check just by choosing the appropriate parameters in order to match whatever your Hoyne series, whatever series recurrence you're given. So those are the simplest possible special function, non-trivial special functions that you can define on the projective line. Solutions of second-order scalar differential equations, which are a Fuchsian type, and the number of singular points is equal to 3 or 4, depending on whether you have the Gauss hypergeometric equation or the Hoyne equation. The Hoyne equation was due to Karl Hoyne. several generations after Gauss. It was a subject of some interest in the 19th century, in fact, a special case of it, the Lemay equation, which you'll find treated in the final chapter of Whitaker and Watson, attracted even more attention. I recently published a paper on the Lemay equation, attempting to work out explicit closed-form integral representations for its solutions, which could be generalized to the general Hoyne equation. The Hoyne equation can also be generalized in other directions. There are confluent Hoyne equations out there with irregular singular points. The Hoyne equation, though, has not been too heavily used by applied mathematicians and the special functions community, the Abramowitz and Stegen or Bateman community, in part because the standard special functions that you encounter, Bessel functions and so forth, tend to be ones which are not defined from first principles like this. They just tend to be the ones that arise from separation of variables, perhaps, or in group representation theory, Vilenkin style. When I got involved in special functions, my initial goal was to derive for the special function HL, the canonical solution of the Hoyne equation, analogs of 2F1, or Gauss hypergeometric function identities. And those would include what I will call degree 1 rational transformations, higher degree rational transformations, and algebraic transformations. Those are simply identities in which the independent variable on the left and right hand sides are transformed in the way that I just said. So you have something like 2F1 or HL on the left hand side, and you have it on the right hand side too. And the independent variables on the two sides are related by particular transformations, rational, higher degree 1, like a Möbius transformation, or higher degree rational, or algebraic. And as I remarked there, the famous sort of degree 1 rational transformations that are encountered in the theory of the Gauss hypergeometric functions are the ones that show up in Kummer's famous 24 solutions of the Gauss hypergeometric equation. Then there are quadratic and higher order rational transformations, which I'm going to skip over. What I'm going to do is give you, to set the scene, a very rapid discussion of what degree one rational transformations look like, and then suddenly leap into algebraic transformations and make the connection with Picard-Fuchs equations and coverings of modular curves by other modular curves and parameterizations of pairs of isogenous elliptic curves. So first, degree one rational transformations. Some of you may have seen these already. These are examples of Kummer's 24 series solutions of the Gauss hypergeometric equation. There are 24 because there are 6 Frobenius solutions of the Gauss hypergeometric equation. There are 6 because there are 3 regular singular points. There are 2 exponents at each. So if you do Boyson de Prima style construction of solutions of the Gauss hypergeometric equation, you get 6 solutions, 6 which are not independent, of course. It's a second order equation. The identities implicit in Kummer's 24 solutions are effectively this. Focus on one particular one of those 6 Frobenius solutions. There's 2F1. Our initial analytic function at x equals 0. It can be written in 4 equivalent ways. Besides 2F1 itself, there are equivalent forms. And the identities are ones that simply say that 2F1 is equal to any one of the other 3. Notice that there's a Möbius transformation that appears in the independent variable. And the first one here is just the identity. Here you have x over x minus 1 appearing. And it's not an accident that that swaps the two regular singular points at x equals 1 and x equals 0. And you can do something similar writing down explicit expressions for the other Frobenius solutions. For example, the 0 exponent solution at x equals 1 can be expressed in terms of 2f1 that way. Now, where do these 24 come from, and how could one reasonably hope to write down analogs for the Hoyne equation? Well, the reason is this. As I said, the Möbius transformations are automorphisms of the projective line, and they permute the 3 singular points, 0, 1, and infinity. They're 3 points. There's a symmetric group on three letters, which permutes them, and there you see explicitly the Möbius transformations that permute those three regular singular points. There are also some linear changes of the dependent variable of the Gauss hypergeometric equation, which I'll write in Riemann's P symbol notation, which you may not be familiar with. These are just tableaus of characteristic exponents. So in the upper row, you see the location of the singular points, and in, immediately beneath each singular point, you see the characteristic exponents. If I, let's say, multiply by a power of 1 minus x or x minus 1, that's simply going to shift the characteristic exponents at the singular point x equals 1. And also, because that prefactor has non-trivial behavior out at infinity, it's also going to shift the exponents out at infinity. Notice what happens when I multiply by that prefactor. I said originally that I wanted there to be a zero exponent at each of the two finite singular points. That property is preserved if I start out with theta 1 as the non-zero exponent at x equals 1. Then when I multiply by this prefactor, the non-zero exponent switches to negative theta 1. So we have here what looks like a group in embryo of characteristic exponent negations. There's a corresponding negation out at infinity, which is simply the interchange of the two characteristic exponents, A and B. Applied mathematicians working on special functions often call these Fuchsian homotopies. I'm not sure if they really understand what homotopy groups are, but they do call them F-homotopies. I would probably just call them index flips. So what's going on when you write down the four variants of each of the six Frobenius solutions is that you are really writing down variants which are indexed by the various possible automorphisms generated by these two subgroups of automorphisms that I've outlined here, number one and number two, which stabilize whichever singular point the solution is defined in a neighborhood of, and also perform no index flip or F homotopy there. That is really where the four variants of each of the six Frobenius solutions come from. There is a group, call it the Kummer group, of transformations of the Gauss hypergeometric equation. What is its group structure? Amazingly, until the last few years, when I wrote it down and a few other people wrote it down, it was very hard to find in the literature a clear statement of what the group structure of this finite group was or is. Bernie Dwork, the late Bernie Dwork, once in a paper wrote down that the group structure is isomorphic to the octahedral group S4. But he didn't really explain why. The reason is essentially this. There are two kinds of transformations. There are the Möbius automorphisms and then these index flips. And the former normalize the latter. So the group generated by the two of them is going to be a semi-direct product of the two. The Möbius transformation group is isomorphic to S3. The index flips index flip group is isomorphic to, call it Z2 cubed, because there are three singular points and you can flip exponents of any one of them. If you disregard the interchange out at infinity, which many people would do, that's the interchange of the parameters A and B, then it's just Z2 squared. The former normalizes the latter. You get a semi-direct product, which by examination is the Reith product of Z2 with S3, which is the Coxeter group, B3. Or if you leave out the interchange of exponents at infinity, you get an index 2 subgroup, which is the Coxeter group, D3, of order 48 or 24, respectively. The latter, more or less by accident, being isomorphic to the octahedral group, S4. And the Kummer group, as I said, is alternatively either the Coxeter group, B3, or D3. Those are alternatively known as the group of signed permutations of three objects and the group of even signed permutations of three objects, the latter being isomorphic to S4, as you can easily check. Here I give you an explicit indexing by signed permutations of Kummer's solutions. Amazingly, you can hunt high and low in the literature and not see an explicit indexing of this sort until I wrote it down. Here you see 2F1 itself, that corresponds to the identity element. That's my notation for signed permutations of three objects, the identity element. It looks just